What were your thoughts on the debate last night?
Well, I thought Mr. Trump held it together a little bit for the first half, but then he fractured quite a lot in the second half. And the idea of not supporting the winner of the presidential election or not recognizing it is, I don't know, that strikes me as not very American. So I definitely would give that debate to Mrs. Clinton, at least on points. And I thought her strongest substantive point was when she said that he's really a very divisive guy with a kind of dark vision for America, which I do think is true. And it's an unusual year for sure for a candidate like that to be at the top of one of the major party tickets.
Sure. It's been, like you said, it's been a very interesting campaign, presidential campaign this year so far. Why have you and Gary Johnson decided to hit the trail and join in?
Well, it's a wonderful year to run as a Libertarian Party candidate, my goodness, because both the candidates of the R and the D Party have their detractors. And there's a path up the middle for us ideologically. Our ticket is fiscally conservative, fiscally responsible, and we can prove it. We're both two-term Republican governors who served in blue states and worked across the aisle to bring fiscal balance back to those states. They were both shuddering when we took over. I came right after Michael Dukakis as governor in Massachusetts, and his people said on top of the table that when I was just taking running for office and then taking office that the state was bankrupt, couldn't pay its bills. So we had to be fiscally conservative. And at the same time, Gary Johnson, the former two-term governor of New Mexico, we were both serving as Republicans, he balanced the budget just like I did, and he vetoed 750 spending bills and was only overridden twice out of 750 times, despite the fact that his legislature was 2-1 Democratic. Mine was 3.5-1 Democratic. So we've got a lot to talk about, and on the social side of the issues, we're sort of inclusive and welcoming, kind of the opposite of Donald Trump, again, like we're the opposite of the Democrats on the spending. So we had a pretty good path up the middle. I think it's fair to say that we're the centrist offering in this year's election, the Libertarian Party.
And what is it about the Libertarian Party vision that's right for this country and South Dakota?
Well, I think balancing your checkbook at the end of every year, the same way all householders have to do by the end of every month, is probably a pretty good idea. And if we continue to spend money like it was water, like they do in D.C., I mean, they honestly think in Washington when they turn those government printing presses round and round and green stuff comes out the end, they think it's free. That was the theme of Senator Sanders' campaign, much of which has been adopted by Mrs. Clinton. And that is going to have the effect, if it's unchecked, of hollowing out the economy. And it's not just a ledger entry. It will translate to the loss of scores of millions of jobs and put us at a competitive disadvantage internationally and be very bad for the jobs and the economy of the United States. So that's issue number one that it's important to focus on. Also, you know, I spoke earlier of Mr. Trump's sort of divisiveness and trying to set group against group. And he seems to be appealing to the worst emotions in people, you know, rage or envy or resentment. And it's just no way to run a country. It's not like when, you know, I dimly remember Eisenhower as president, but I do remember everyone thought it was great to be an American. Same with Reagan. He made people feel good about being an American. And it almost seems like Donald Trump wants to make his voters feel bad about being American. So I think it's an important election, both because I think the two-party monopoly in Washington has kind of outlived its usefulness. For the last 15 years, those two parties in D.C., and I've had a front-row seat, they just want to kill each other. And they're united only in wanting to maintain their monopoly. And so, you know, this year they both argue, oh, you can't possibly vote for the Libertarians because then my opponent might get elected. But there's no analysis behind that. That assumes its own conclusion. It's not a logical argument. It just means I really want to win and I want to kill my opponent. And that degree of negativity among the I'll call them not even the major parties. I'll call them the establishment parties. I think has sent some people our way.
Certainly. And I guess why are you and I know Governor Johnson is coming to South Dakota a little bit later. I think next week. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Why are you campaigning in South Dakota when there's only three electoral college votes here?
Well, I'm campaigning in a bunch of rural states where we think our message is well received. Rural states tend to be a little bit more independent minded. You know, they elect independent governors and senators. I've spent a bit of time in Maine recently, and we have a good showing here. A lot of supporters. Senator Stan Edelstein is our chairman here, very prominent South Dakotan, and we have thousands of supporters and hundreds of volunteers. We've got a little office right down the street on Kansas City Street. So it looks like an opportune place for us. I also enjoy places like this. I grew up in the country and did a lot of upland hunting on our property when I was growing up, and we were right on the Canadian Flyway, so I had duck hunting, a lot of trout fishing. So Gary and I are both outdoorsmen all the way. Gary's a native of North Dakota and grew up in South Dakota in Aberdeen. So he's very much at home here too, so you'll see both of us. And I've been here for a while. I got into Sioux Falls a couple days ago, and we'll have spent three or three and a half days here by the time I jet out back to the east.
What would it mean to the Libertarian Party if you could pull South Dakota even?
Oh, I think taking a state would be of great splash value. You know, the thing people always say about Ross Perot is he got 19% of the vote, but he didn't win a state. Well, I think getting 19% of the vote is a pretty big achievement, but people tend to notice who wins states and who doesn't, and they always hark back to George Wallace winning five states, and you know, we'll be contesting at least that number of states, and we'll see how we make out, but I think we're going to have some in the W column.
Sure. Is it a long-term vision, like the ripple that starts the wave?
I think it's a long-term vision. I mean, I've been saying since the beginning of the campaign that I think the National Republican Party may very well fracture in two, either this cycle or by the latest at the next cycle. And Mr. Trump feels the same way. He says he sees a very different Republican Party in 5 years. And I'm sure the party he sees is the Trump Party. And I think that'll be one of the elements that divides. And the parallel with the breakup of the Whig Party in the 1850s is really arresting. They were founded on anti-immigrant prejudice. They were a very anti-Catholic group. So they hated all the immigrants coming in from Ireland and Italy and Germany, most of whom were Catholic. And they had violent rallies, and they dealt in conspiracy theories, just almost a carbon copy of the Trump movement. And when the party split up, mostly over the issue of slavery, that faction, which was called the Know-Nothing faction, and they called themselves the Know-Nothing faction, they were proud of it. They disappeared after a couple of years, just dissipated. And the other half, the majority faction of the party, went on to elect Abraham Lincoln president of the United States 3 years later, because this big breakup started in mid-1850s, really came to a climax in 1857. So that could be a happy ending for the Republican Party.
Sure. I want to dive into some of your campaign's policies here. You were mentioning stuff about, I guess, lower government and that sort of thing. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Well, I've been around government for a while, and I've never seen a layer of government at any level, federal, state, local, that couldn't be 10 or 20% smaller. And government tends to grow on its own, and the legislators in particular, they want to get reelected, and the best way they think to do that is by spending money. So there's a natural upward trend that takes government to a size greater than it needs to be, and that comes out of the taxpayers' hides. You got to pay for that. One of my maxims when I was governor was there's no such thing as government money. There's only taxpayers' money. And Gary and I were both reelected with pretty good votes. You know, his reelect was much higher than his initial vote, and I got in with like 50.02% of the vote in my first election, and we got reelected with 71% of the vote, and that's in Massachusetts. So, and we were both known for being fiscal conservatives. So I think taxpayers do appreciate that kind of frugality. And Gary and I would, if we get to Washington, either from the House or however we got there, we would set about bringing a balanced budget within our first 100 days. And the only way to do that is what's called zero basing the budget. You assume that every appropriation is zero until it justifies itself otherwise. So if you had, for example, in the healthcare area, a preventive health program that had, you know, avoided a lot of diseases, wasn't very expensive, produced a lot of good outcomes for patients, because preventive is always a better way, you might multiply that appropriation by 10 because it's such a good idea. And if you had a much bigger appropriation that created a huge bureaucracy that was, you know, somewhere between the Treasury Department and the Labor Department and the Justice Department and Homeland Security, and nobody could tell you really what it did, but it was very popular and had a lot of political connections, that'd be a candidate for zero. That's why they call it zero-based budgeting. And people say, how can you possibly do that? How can you possibly cut the military? Well, I mean, the Pentagon itself, which runs the military, says it has 20% more bases than it needs. It says its salary and benefits is probably 20% higher than it needs. There's been quite a run-up there. And that's the people that run the military. But Congress has said, no, we love spending money, so we're not going to do that. But it's not that the savings aren't there. It's that people in Washington lack the political will to make those cuts. You know, for Governor Johnson and myself, governor was our first elective office, and that was an advantage for each of us, because we didn't recognize sacred cows in the budget. I mean, we didn't even know that they were cows, much less that they were sacred. So we had no compunctions about making the cuts that had to be made. Washington desperately needs that right now.
So I guess you're disagreeing with Donald Trump's assertion that the military is vastly underfunded and they're being left out in the dark, that they
like almost everything else Mr. Trump says. I'll give him his due. He's right twice a day. So's a broken clock. But he plucked that out of the air. And his multi-hundred billion dollar proposals seem to come out of nowhere. They're just they sound good to him at the time. His there's no other word for it. His ignorance of, global trade and economic issues is really amazing. And as is his take on many issues of significance to the world. One example would be nuclear weapons. The spread of nuclear weapons is probably the greatest danger facing the world today. I happen to belong to a group of former world leaders. You have to be a head of state to be there, but they elected me because the American member is Bill Clinton, and he's a valued member, but he often doesn't get there, and they want to make sure they have a Yankee to beat up on and tell him what's going on in Washington. And they all say that nuclear proliferation is the number one danger facing the world today. Well, Mr. Trump has suggested that might be a handy idea for the Japanese and the South Koreans to have nuclear weapons, because they're in areas prone to war and they have opponents who have nuclear weapons. That's not very clear thinking for a president of the United States.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. So I guess I want to get back to government spending, and how does that help, build the economy or help the middle class? Because that seems to be like the main theme with both what Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump were saying last night about growing the middle class.
It doesn't really, just by virtue of being government spending. Gary likes to point out that in the 2012 campaign, he was given credit for having created the most jobs as governor of New Mexico in the previous term. And he said, Gary didn't create any jobs. Those jobs are created in the private sector by small and medium-sized businesses. And that's where the jobs come from. And that is a distinct point of view. I mean, it's a correct point of view, but it happens to be distinct from the majority Democratic view. Both President Obama and Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts have gone to groups of small businesses and said, hey, so you got a good company going here and you employ a bunch of people, goody for you, congratulations. But let me tell you something, buddy, you didn't create that job. The government created that job with its roads and bridges. I mean, that's the most cockeyed thing I've ever heard in my life, but they really seem to believe it. These people are addicted to government. It's a bad thing. That hurts jobs. That doesn't create jobs.
Sure. I guess there might be a little bit of an argument, a perspective out there that says, you know, like a lot of these, might not be able to operate if there aren't roads and bridges there that are subsidized by the government. The logging industry here in the Black Hills, for example, without, I guess, help from the National Forest
Service. You do need the building blocks of a society, of a civil society, and it's acknowledged that the government is responsible for paying for that. But I don't think anyone is sort of suggesting that we shouldn't have roads. You know, that's part of having an advanced society. But it's innovation, it's entrepreneurialism, it's inventive spirit, where the United States, and it may be all the way back to our beginnings, but we just have a huge edge in that over the rest of the world. China is probably number two in inventiveness, but they are way behind us. And one of the reasons why the United States always wins with free trade is that we have higher productivity per worker by a mile. So that if, say, there's free trade in North America, like the North American Free Trade Agreement, yes, it is true that some lower-end stages of the construction of an automobile may occur in Mexico because the labor costs are lower. But that means that the companies are going to be able to save money on the production costs so that they will be able to sell more cars in Asia against the Korean and Japanese competitors and make more money and employ many more people in higher wage jobs in the United States, like marketing or engineering. So, I think the government, because of the impact on the economy of these trade agreements, has a responsibility to focus on the possibilities for worker retraining programs, even resettlement, work with the private sector in encouraging the development of new replacement industries, because the economy doesn't stand still. You know, one of the amazing things about Mr. Trump's call for a closed economy and tariffs and protectionism, it's a call for a return to the buggy whip era. It's like the automobile had never been invented. And we would be absolutely up the creek if we listened to that advice. My hope is, and you know, our ticket, Johnson Weld and the Libertarians, is really the only free trade ticket out there, because both Mrs. Clinton and Mr. Trump have set their face against the global economy, because you know Trump has tapped a vein of anger there from people who didn't advance in the global economy. And, you know, there are winners and there are losers. And I'm saying we have a responsibility to look after the people or try to improve the lot of those who suffer as a result of worldwide trends. But that doesn't mean you spit in the eye of the worldwide trends. You really won't get too far doing that.
I don't want to take up too much of your time.
No,
I have a couple more questions.
Sure.
I guess, as I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, there's more of the less government is involved in the free market, the better. Is that a good standard?
Yeah, no.
Correct?
Gary Johnson frequently rails against what he calls crony capitalism, which is the government sidling up to big businesses and trying to influence who wins and who loses. And in return, the big businesses make a lot of campaign contributions, and it's pay to play, and that's not really long-term a healthy situation. So, in the healthcare area, for example, you know, we'd like to stop having all the decisions made by the government and the big insurance companies, and have more of the decisions made by patients and doctors. So you get more of a market element in there. Maybe people would, you know, have to have a catastrophic illness coverage, but that is, I don't know, one-tenth as expensive as these huge cradle to grave, all possible illnesses policies that everyone is supposed to have now. So our view would be, you know, maybe you have a health savings account, you have a catastrophic illness policy, but when you have, you know, you want to have something done with gallbladders, you go to gallbladder specialists. Gary says gallbladders are us. And you say, you know, I want to have this done, and they'll say, okay, that'll be $175. Here's what we'll do. So it's all out in the open, willing buyer, willing seller. No middleman, which means the buyer pays less and the seller makes more money. And that's an oversimplification, but that's sort of our view of the ideal way for the economy to be organized. Not with the government in the middle as a middleman who takes a slice. You can even see it as state governors. We both saw it where you'd have to send 20 cents to Washington to support some department, and they'd send back 12 cents. You know, that's Washington efficiency running as usual. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're not without experience in our recommendation that government be trimmed.
Where's that line, I guess, where government should be involved in the market?
Well, I think if there's a market failure, government can take action to make sure that people aren't victimized by a market failure. Government can also, on the upside, try to create conditions that are hospitable for job creation. For example, tax cuts. You know, in my two terms, I cut taxes 21 times, never raised them. In Gary's two terms, he cut taxes 14 times, never raised them. And a lot of my tax cuts weren't that big. They might be a tax credit here, or my favorite was actually zeroing out the long-term capital gains tax. And that was 6% in Massachusetts. And I didn't have the votes to repeal the whole thing. But I said, well, why don't we knock off a percent for every year you hold an asset? And this would apply to the family farm or Krugerrands, any type of capital asset. So if you hold it for 6 years, the capital gains tax is zero. So there's just a little bite every year in terms of revenue. So I was able to persuade the legislature to go along with that. People started investing in plant and equipment like you couldn't believe, and that creates spillover jobs all over. So by the end of just my first term, our unemployment rate, which was the highest among the then 11 industrial states when I came in, went to the lowest unemployment rate among the 11 industrial states. And I'm sure that contributed to our reelect numbers. But so there are tweaks and things government can do, but it should be, you know, with a view to creating favorable conditions for job creation. You know, if I had to put in a sentence what Gary's and my ambition would be, it would be to maximize the happiness and the prosperity and the liberty and freedom of the American people, and, you know, hold everything to that yardstick. And prosperity is important. You know, property is right there in the Constitution. So, and I think libertarians are friendly towards property issues as well.
Sure, sure. And another thing that you kind of hinted at was, I guess, sort of personal freedoms and a lot of social issues. What are some of those major social issues that?
Well, anything that's what John Stuart Mill called self-regarding conduct. You know, the government should have no business there. And Gary and I were both lone wolves here. I was a lone wolf for a decade on gay and lesbian civil rights. I had some friends who were gays and lesbians, and it just outraged me that that they had were so looked down on in society. So I started issuing executive orders saying, okay, henceforth, gays and lesbians have visitation and bereavement rights, and we're going to do a task force on teenage suicide, because we had this rash of suicides among teenagers who were bullied at school because they were gay or lesbian, and they go kill themselves. And I thought, this is just not a good thing. So I set a special task force to hold hearings on that, and that addressed that problem. And come to find out, a lot more families had gays and lesbians somewhere in the family than people had thought. But for a decade, I was the only governor doing that. People, you know, I had friends among the Democratic governors as well as the Republicans, because although I was fiscal conservative, I was a social liberal like most of the Democratic governors, and they would just joke with me and say, Bill, don't you know you're supposed to be all one way? You're not supposed to do one thing and the other. So that's one example. Gary spent a decade in the wilderness as coming out for the legalization of marijuana, starting in the late 90s. And in both cases, I think public opinion has caught up to us. But it's, you know, and it's not that we want to sell our opinions or ram them down anybody else's throat. For example, I was very active on the pro-choice side of the abortion issue. Thought it should be left up to the woman. Government should have no involvement there. But about half my supporters were pro-life. They were very much anti-abortion. Thought there should be rules restricting it. And there are rules already, you know, up to the point of quickening. It's the current law of the land is the government does have an interest in restricting abortion. And that was the rule of common law before anyone ever thought of the Supreme Court getting into this. So maybe we'll go back there. But our point is, you're pro-life, that's great. We're not going to, we're not going to go tisk tisk. Just everybody should have their own views there. And that would extend to the marijuana issue and gay rights, abortion, all self-regarding conduct.
Is there anything else that you wanted to add to our discussion here? What would you like to say to, I guess, the voters of South Dakota that I didn't ask?
I would say that Gary Johnson and Bill Weld feel very comfortable in South Dakota. It's a state that we are focusing on very much in this campaign. We've got a great command staff and structure here, and we think the reason we feel so comfortable here is that the value system of the citizens of South Dakota is pretty much our own. We're both wide open spaces guys.
Yeah, certainly. Thank you very much for
okay, thank
sitting
you.
Here and talking to
Pleasure.
Me. Appreciate
Pleasure.
Appreciate it.